Nations in the National Assembly, as well as in the National Council of Provinces, in terms of the Moneyballs Act, how we have to conduct our work referring to the MPBBS this time of the financial year. Welcome to the Honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, with the team of Treasury, DG, etc. Excuse me. Also to our Honourable Members from the relevant committees, but also welcome to provinces, Honourable Minister, that are also present here. Limpopo, just indicate where is Limpopo. Gauteng, the economic heartthrob of Africa. Northern Cape, the biggest province, Northern Cape, with flowers in Namakwa, and Eastern Cape. So welcome to those provinces. If there's anyone left out, that's a note I received. Free State, we're here yesterday. There's Free State. Mpumalanga, where's Mpumalanga? Where the sun rises, welcome. Well, we contemplate on that one, Mpumalanga. And Free State. Western Cape? No, not you. The provincial legislator. They are not here, but they were here yesterday. I saw the chairperson. Yeah. All the members, it's 10 to 10. We must proceed with our program. Yesterday, the Minister for Finance tabled the MPBBS. Immediately after the speech, the markets responded positively by 0.12% upwards. That's a message not only for South Africa, but for the world. And it's a message that we will have to take up. So thank you for the motion of confidence that you actually restored, Minister, looking at the fiscal policies that were followed since 1994. Just to give you some background, and then I'll hand over to Co-Chairperson Thabo Mofumahadi. 1994, the total revenue totaled 112.4 billion. Expenditure 37 billion, sorry, and debt service cost 24.1 billion. That was about 48% of GDP. That's where we come from. To measure where we are now, it's important to see where we come from over the past decade plus. Honourable Chairperson, I'm handing over to you. Thank you. Minister, welcome. We're going to give you the opportunity to make your inputs on the fiscal framework. We will do that. After that, the finance chairpersons will leave the chairs and we go into the appropriations part of the meeting, dealing with amendments to the Division of Revenue, etc. Then Honourable Sigourney and Honourable Chani will chair the meeting.
Maybe just on that one, we should maybe allow the minister and his team to take us on how they're intending to handle the presentation, and then we'll take it from there.
Chairpersons, good morning, and good morning to our visitors from the provinces and to honourable members. We could handle all of those elements together, but if under your guidance, let's finish the first part and then move quickly into the second part, and you can manage the musical chairs as you see fit on your side, if that's okay. So we'll present, even including the division of revenue, in one go, and then we'll take it from there, if that's okay with you. Just by way of introduction and a reminder of what we said yesterday, in quick summary, that the global economy is slowing down. And at some stage, Chairperson, I think it will be very useful for us to get into greater detail about different perspectives on why is the global economy slowing down? Why is Europe not recovering? How do these impacts from Europe and the United States get transferred into China and India and Brazil? And how do the impacts on China and India affect us in South Africa? And it'll be useful to get into the detail of some of those dynamics and the kind of analyses that are available. We say that economic growth in South Africa 5 billion rands less than we thought it would be. We said that there will be no additions to the overall spending levels. By that we mean inclusive of the contingency amounts that we announced in the budget in February 2012. We said the debt will peak at 39% of GDP in 2015-16, and if you look at Mr. De Beers' 1994 numbers, it shows in a short period of 18 years how far we've come as a country. And I'll come back to this point I want to make in a moment. We're saying that strong measures are being taken to ensure value for money in public spending. I know that there's a lot of skepticism around this area, which means that honorable members need to help us as the executive a lot more, particularly our provincial representatives, because our credibility in the public eye is going to be impacted by what provinces do with 44% of the total expenditure that is assigned to provinces. And the same will apply to municipalities, who have both their own revenue and some 9 to 10% of allocations from the national fiscus as well. So what happens in the two spheres of government is as important as what happens at the national sphere of government. And it's something, again, that honorable members need to focus a lot more on, if I may humbly suggest that, and keep a more careful eye on how the public funds are being spent, because when we appear on public platforms, we have to defend the things that are happening way outside of our control. And we have to constantly provide explanations for what is going on in defense of the country's fiscal position and the country's fiscal reputation. And I don't think there's enough of a consciousness, if you like, at other spheres of government in terms of what's going on and how is the appropriate money spent, appropriated money spent, and how it is appropriated in ways that it shouldn't be appropriated. So if you don't mind my emphasis on that, I just come off a radio show, and I have to keep accounting, you know, for what politicians do, what officials do, what business people claim they don't do but do, and in their transactions with government. And I think that a lot more of us should share this pressure and offer the explanations we need to offer to the South African taxpaying public as to what are we doing with their money and what management and careful management are we actually undertaking in this regard as well. We talked about savings and the 40 billion rands that we've saved, if you like, medium-term project of shifting composition of expenditure is still on track. And both the public and ourselves are extremely concerned about procurement processes and supply chain management in government. And in this regard, further steps are being taken with the establishment of the procurement officer. And yet further steps will be taken when we get to the point where infrastructure projects, which will cost billions of rands, are going to be delivered as well. So that broadly is where we're coming from. And what we tried to say yesterday to South Africans is that we will have to dig into our own resources and resolve in order to cope with extreme uncertainties that are hitting us from the global environment. And we can't keep looking at what the globe is doing, because there are opportunities as well, both for government and the private sector in South Africa. And the question is whether we are working cohesively enough to be able to seize those opportunities, and perhaps spending a bit too much of time pointing fingers at one another rather than saying how can we work together in order to seize these opportunities and bring benefits to South Africa and indeed the continent more broadly. At the same time, remember that we are a far more resilient economy than many economies that are impacted negatively at this point in time, so don't talk ourselves down. Give ourselves enough credit for what we are actually trying to do. We're also saying that, and this is in summing up, that we shouldn't shroud ourselves with unnecessary pessimism. We are managing our fiscal trajectory well, and I repeat that we are getting the balance right between medium-term fiscal consolidation and immediate-term support for the economy, and we don't give ourselves enough credit for the kind of choices that we've made, particularly after the recession hit us in 2009. So with those words, let me ask the Director General to go through the presentation he has. You'll have copies, honorable members, at some stage soon, and take you through some of the details, and we will engage thereafter. Thank you.
DG, just before you proceed, Chairpersons Chani and Sagoni, can you please come to the front? We will have two meetings because there must be two sets of minutes dealing with the program as is, so that you will deal with the fiscal framework and then after that, then they take over the case.
No, thank you very much. I think you represent us there. Let us continue.
Please continue.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Chair, honorable members. Thanks, Minister and Deputy Minister. I'm going to approach this presentation on the basis that at least we have heard the speech yesterday, and there is a chance that people have seen at least the short document. I won't take too long to explain things now. If the feeling is that I'm going through it too fast, stop me at any time and say slow down, but I don't want to repeat stuff that people know. This first slide just summarizes the broad themes, shows the revisions that we have effected to the growth projections relative to what we had published in February, and deriving directly from that, it talks to how the deficit is going to unfold over the MTF and a bit on expenditure. On the broad themes, the Minister has indicated the environment in which this budget was tabled, both the global and domestic events have resulted in the downward revisions to the growth forecast. For this year, growth has had to be revised down to 2.5%, but we still expect it to accelerate over the medium term. Next year, just getting to 3% by the third year of the forecast period, reaching 4%. The budget deficit, the Minister has indicated again that in the immediate term, the idea is to support the economy, hence the slight deterioration in the fiscal position, which is not expenditure-induced. Expenditure over the period, for the first 2 years, is exactly the same as it was published, as the figures were published in February. So the slight deterioration this year of the deficit by 0.2% from 4.6 to 4.8 is only as a result of the downward revision of 5 billion in revenue. But we expect, and we will drive an agenda to achieve this, that the deficit would drop to around 3% by the third year of the MTF. Our debt will peak at 39% of GDP, which is way below the levels at which most countries' debt levels are. But of course, I mean, countries differ. It doesn't mean that in our case we have headroom to take up too much more debt and go to the levels that have got some countries into trouble. This very disciplined framework still allows for real growth in expenditure over the medium term, as you can see in the trillion-plus figures that we will be expending over the MTF. Although overall expenditure has been kept constant, a range of priority programs will still receive additional funding from drawdowns of the contingency reserve, but also from the 40 billion that is reallocated, taken away from areas that are of less priority or areas that have been determined not to be requiring as much resources as they had been. I'm not going to spend too much time on this slide. It, in a way, it sets out just the macroeconomic performance and projections for the period, essentially indicating what are the key components of gross domestic expenditure that will be driving the growth in GDP that we're projecting. Perhaps quite importantly is the gross fixed capital formation line, because that is the area where we expect that a lot of stimulus, if you will come from. That is where, in the immediate term, we're looking at the public sector, public entities in particular, investing more, and there will be a slide on this, which I'll pass through quite quickly. But we anticipate that as confidence returns over the medium term, then the private sector will begin to also invest. And when those things happen, we would expect that exports would begin to rise. Inflation, by and large, is expected to remain for most of the time within the target range. Current account balance will widen a bit because we are not selling as much as we buy from the rest of the world, and the disruptions in mining, which makes up about 40% of what we export, although it's small as a percentage of gross domestic product, will account for some of this deterioration. Now, in a nutshell, this slide just shows how the economies in the parts of the world that South Africa trades with, and you will see in a later slide the proportions of our trade that go to the different parts of the world. But the importance of this is that it just shows how pedestrian growth in certain key economies. If you look at advanced economies such as the U.S. over the forecast period is likely to grow by around 2% or below that, which is an economy which is very big as the proportion of the global economy. The euro area, with which South Africa has got very significant trade ties for historical reasons, especially for our manufactured goods, is going to grow very slowly after the contraction that is likely to happen this year. And you can also see that amongst even the BRICS countries, some of them, their growth rates are low, particularly Brazil. China still remains very strong, but a growth rate of below 8% for China is considered by their historical standards, at least certainly recently, to be low. What's impressive is the record for sub-Saharan Africa, which SADC is part, and we've seen an increased increased volumes of trade and monetary terms between South Africa and SADC and the rest of Africa, which is very, very important for our growth prospects. These are some of the global factors which I shall not repeat. The domestic factors, we all know them. The recent strikes, the fact that electricity since 2008 showed up its ugly head as a constraint to this economy, but it's something that is being resolved with Medupi about to switch on its first generator, which will then begin to remove that as a bottleneck to the system. Just broader bottlenecks across the system, with business confidence arising from some of these developments that have occurred here. The current account widening, I've already referred to that. This summarizes the impact of the mining strikes on GDP, and you can see the 10.1 billion that we estimate that so far has been lost as a result of the mining strikes. If they were to be protracted, stay for a longer time, there is a chance that the impact might just be more. But the signs are beginning to suggest that this could change any time. Of course, this goes with slowing down in the rate of job creation in the sector. Employers, more often than not necessarily always right, but they find all manner of ways to adjust to increasing cost of labor. Rather, they may look for ways in which to contain the overall cost by changing the numbers. And of course, we then summarize the impact in terms of taxes and export revenues that we anticipate we may lose. I've referred to that gross fixed capital formation slide earlier, and you can see here summarized in bar chart that the gray part around 2012 is expected to be proportionally larger. That's the public sector investment, in a large part driven by state-owned entities, ESCOM in particular being the biggest investor in infrastructure over the medium term, building those power stations that the country so absolutely needs, and of course followed by Transnet, Sunrail, and TCTA. But we expect that over time, as confidence returns, the private sector too shall begin to invest quite a bit more. The minister's speech and the document make reference, rightly so, to the National Development Plan, which is an important document which identifies some of the challenges, constraints that are holding our country back. But it doesn't stop there. It also makes proposals on what can be done to overcome some of these challenges. The few weeks ago, the President's Leadership Summit was convened, and it made a range of commitments that I would take members had read about. Most importantly is the need to implement everything that we set out in our plans. A plan that doesn't get implemented is not worth the paper that it is written on. It is its execution, its implementation with discipline, on time, within budget, that would determine how successful such a plan is in yielding the intended impact. And in this regard, the minister had referred to the progress that has been made with the implementation of some of the things that were announced in February, investment incentives, manufacturing competitiveness enhancement program, the renewable energy independent power program, which the preparatory work and the necessary sign-offs have just happened in the week that we are in, and of course the city support program, which is intended to assist the cities in taking a long-term view in planning and integrating their infrastructure in the period ahead. This slide just summarizes the growth in gross fixed capital formation by type and by sector. Strikingly, you can see electricity, the bar that relates to electricity is the longest, or tallest, depending on how you change this graph, but that signals the importance of ESCOM, and it's an appropriate and required investment given what happened in 2008. And you can see, again, when you translate it by type, that public corporations, as I indicated, make up the biggest proportion of the investment. And of course, in time, they should crowd in the private sector, and the two working together should produce the kind of results that our country so desired. We talked about exports. I referred to this when I was talking about the current account deficit, but also when I was indicating that some of the countries are battling. You can see that the changes in what we export to Japan, which is not only a function of demand from Japan, but it's also because Japan is the biggest buyer of our platinum. When there's no platinum that's dug out of the ground, there's no platinum to sell to Japan. And that explains the contraction in what has gone to Japan. Impressively is what is going to SADC, which a significant proportion of which is consisting of our manufacturing goods. But you can see that the disruptions, we mentioned them here in relation to trade with Japan, Germany,
and of course the U.S. The development of trade changes in trade patterns with countries like China, India, and of course Africa, and in particular our SADC region, is a welcome one, because those are the regions that have demonstrated some resilience in these difficult times, which then suggests that if more and more of our exports get destined to these places, our chances of exporting more, in taking advantage of increasing demand in these areas, would improve the prospects for growth for our own manufacturing country and of course job creation. Yeah. Current account deficit, this is a function really of the extent to which we produce at competitive prices and sell to the rest of the world, and the world buys from us. The financial relations between ourselves and the rest of the world, when people invest here, as they take dividends and sometimes even repatriate the capital, then the net position would change depending on the outcome. And you can see that in the year that we're in, we'll have to finance a current account deficit of about 189 billion. This is why it's important that our country should remain seen as an attractive place to either invest in bonds, equities, and even foreign direct investment, so that we can be able to raise the foreign currency that we need to be able to meet the liabilities that arise from our trading and other financial relations with the rest of the world. We show in this slide that as a result of slowing growth, employment has decelerated somewhat. It's very important. Even if you were to improve the intensity of employment of an economy, you can do that only up to a point. And in an environment where pressures for wages to increase is very high, then the ability to absorb more labor without growth has got limitations. What an economy needs is a high rate of growth, high enough that the rate at which opportunities for new jobs are created would be high. With an unemployment rate of 25%, we need far much higher levels of growth to be able to absorb those who are added to the economically active proportion of our population. Formal non-agricultural employment in pre-1999 rose by about 125,000 jobs, but in recent times what we see is a slowing down of that. The public sector employment has risen by 38,000 jobs in recent times, compared to 87 for the past period. You can see that nominal wages have risen a little bit quite significantly in the recent past, with the comparisons there for 2012 and 2011. But over the period ahead, we are focusing that about 780,000 jobs would be created. Now, we have witnessed recently some volatility of our currency. In particular, in recent times, the exchange rate depreciated quite a bit. This is as a result of, you know, financial turmoil globally and swings in risk appetite. Some investors feeling a bit jittery about development here and pulling out, or some of them just stopping, not coming. So sentiment towards the rand has been negative for some time, accounted for in significant part by the strikes, but also some people then, when they noticed the deterioration in the current account, they got a little bit jittery and worried. But what we see is that the nominal trade weighted rand over the recent period has depreciated by about 10% relative to the same period a year ago. But what really matters or determines the competitiveness of a country is what happens to the real effective exchange rate. And insofar as that is concerned, we have not seen a real depreciation, in part because of the stubbornness in the cost structure of our economy. Now, the fiscal framework that was tabled, and a lot of this the minister covered, so I'll be very quick and I'll just do the headlines. I mean, our fiscal framework remains grounded in a sustainable countercyclical approach that seeks to ensure that there is intergenerational fairness or equity over the long term, balances medium-term consolidation and short-term economic support. There are three policy objectives that it seeks to achieve: moderating expenditure growth, stabilizing government debt, to which I referred earlier on, and improving outcomes and shifting the composition of expenditure. Perhaps I would draw the committee's two committees' attention to the objective of narrowing the primary deficit down to 0.4% of GDP by the third year of this medium-term expenditure framework. The fiscal framework itself, the most important business or item for today, or one of the two most important items for the day, perhaps the quite pointedly, we should just look at, you know, the revenue figure for this year. We are looking at budget revenue of about 900 billion, revised expenditure of 1.057 trillion, and of course those are the figures over the MTF. Non-interest expenditure excluding debt service costs, the figures are set out there. And state debt, which is what Chairperson De Beer was referring to, is projected to be about 89 billion this year, set to rise to about 114.8 billion by 2015-16. In percentage terms, nowhere close to the figures that the Honorable De Beer was quoting. We're looking at 2.6% by the third year of this fiscal this framework. The deficits for the 4 years, the revised one for this year, 4.8, next year 4.5, falling to 3% by the third year of this MTF. The part that I really like about this slide is the panel on the right-hand side, because it just shows you that in the past, the red bar, which is the compensation of employees, had grown much faster than the rest of the components of expenditure. But going forward, we are looking at capital, the black bar, growing faster, which is more in line with the change in the composition of expenditure that we seek to accomplish. And on the opposite side, the red bar on the right-hand panel, extreme right, shows that personnel costs wouldn't rise too fast. We are optimistic that we would achieve this, especially in the context of the multi-year agreement that we have achieved this year, which locks the cost per employee at predictable levels. And now with the decisions that Cabinet have taken, insofar as the numbers are concerned, trying to restrain them, the growth in the numbers, then this should be quite achievable. This repeats really what I've said. Otherwise, I'll keep you here forever. And even in this slide, if you think about it, perhaps the issue to draw your attention to is just the public sector borrowing requirement, the borrowing by the state plus state-owned entities, which is said to be around 7.1%. This is the claim to resources, so to speak, perhaps put in inverted commas, because it's going to be borrowed money by the entities to invest in infrastructure, but for government, just for general expenditure. This one of our we hope that it is the infrastructure investment program that's going to drive growth, and here we just indicate the projects and the various stages at which they are. The 3.2 trillion, as was announced in February, or if you will, then there is a recent figure of about 4 trillion that has been mentioned. But you can see that if you look at the top bar for state-owned entities, the grey part, which indicates projects that are several months, some of them maybe a few years even, to being shovel ready, because as they move from the grey to red, and I suppose it's indigo, whatever that color on ongoing is, it takes time through the decision gates. So the grey bar must get smaller and begin to be reddish. Then you realize that it's hitting the ground. And the the sort of checking or the sort of feasibility, it's more about evaluating a project against other options, whether it is the best option, whether it is doable given all considerations, technical and otherwise, in a particular country. And of course, determining then the technical appropriateness as a solution to whatever problem or constraint is intended. Now, 250 billion worth of projects that are shovel ready are provided for within the framework that was presented yesterday. The division of revenue, the headlines, essentially national government takes up 47 billion, provinces 44, local government 9. What's important about this is that the local government share is rising in line with the desire to try and make sure that that sphere is equipped to begin to deliver more social and economic infrastructure in line with sort of the developmental objective of government. The bulk of what provinces spend their money on is social services, which are very important in achieving equality of opportunity, equity in ensuring that people can rise from the bottom of the pyramid up. Now, these services, as I will refer to when I talk about the adjustments just now, are personally intensive. They use a lot of teachers, nurses, and other professionals. So every time wage bill increases, more and more resources have to be allocated to this sphere to meet those financial commitments. There has been reprioritization of funds, 40 billion, so much talked about yesterday and today in interviews. So funds were shifted away from programs that are not expected to disperse funds as quickly as initially scheduled. And the areas that have been the main recipients of the resources are listed here. Now, it's important to perhaps pause and indicate that we're shifting gear now when we get here, not as in growth, employment, and redistribution. But this now talks to the adjustment appropriation, Mr. Zavoni and Mr. Shah, which are the revisions to the appropriation that's currently going. And to those who have got the MTBPS, if you don't, I would encourage my colleagues behind me to perhaps distribute them to you, because they are somewhere in the box here. Otherwise, it will be fruitless and wasteful expenditure. But on page 36 of it, the revisions to the 2012 estimate are summarized very nicely. They don't even need to be captured in any presentation. 11.5 billion in additional appropriations is provided for. 5.5 billion is meant to deal with the 2 percentage point difference between what was assumed in February and what the wage settlement ultimately ended up when the negotiations were concluded. That 5.5 billion is shared between national government and provinces. Just over 4 billion of it going to provinces, in line with the personnel intensity that I was referring to earlier, and about 1.4 billion, I think, going to national departments, shared amongst them, again, depending on the proportions of employment in those departments. That immediately affects the division of revenue, because it means that the division of revenue then has to be amended to add that amount to provinces and the bit to national government. 2.3 billion covers unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure, 1.5 rollovers, 0.4 billion or 400 million self-financing expenditure, 1.8 for the skills levy and CETAs. These are offset by the following: 5.8 billion a drawdown on the contingency reserve, 3 billion declared savings from among departments, half a billion money that was underspent by local government, which has to revert to the National Revenue Fund, 3.5 billion projected underspending, and just over half a billion from lower than originally anticipated debt service costs. Now, on that page, without going through the list, the division in terms of the amounts and the specific items to which the resources are allocated for national government, for provinces, and a little bit, the 1.3 million for local government. These are set out just for purposes of the record and minuting, I should indicate. And of course, this then affects, has got to be translated into the division of revenue amendment bill, and of course the adjusted appropriation bill. These are the changes to the provincial equitable share grant, which is now going to talking the forward estimate. 27.7 billion is going to be added to the provincial equitable share over the next 3 years to deal with the cost of the wage agreement. Total for both spheres is about 37, 38 billion. Growth in the numbers of health professionals, it's also kind of provided for here, and appointment of social workers that have been trained using bursaries from government. There are also conditional grant amounts that are allocated for education infrastructure, for antiretroviral medicines, particularly in the third year, if I'm correct, for that. And of course, there are also proposed adjustments to various conditional grants that are listed on this slide. Now, there are also changes proposed to the local government equitable share going forward. To compensate for a range of things, chief among these, the municipalities, for increased costs to provide basic services. Just as electricity tariffs increase, for example, water tariffs increase, that component which is provided for free, the subsidy that goes for that, has got to be adjusted commensurately to accommodate this. Other conditional grants to assist municipalities to roll out infrastructure. Over the past, we've seen 100 billion allocated for this purpose. There will be targeted reforms to some of these conditional grants to try and make sure that they are more aligned to the purposes that we want to achieve, with some of the bigger cities encouraged to facilitate better integration of human settlements, providing all the infrastructure up to the top structure for the delivery of sustainable human settlements, so to speak. And of course, technical support will be provided to rural municipalities to make sure that they can deliver safe drinking water, sanitation, and of course, electrification. Usually at this time, we would update the formula for allocating all grants, equitable share grants and conditional grants, because we would use the midterm estimates for population. But now that we have had the census, which will be released end of this month, in a couple of days, I presume, then the formula will have to be updated for population, for economic profiles, backlogs in infrastructure, all relevant components. And that stage is yet to be done, and I think we will have to come back to the committees and brief them about that once that information has been plugged into the formula, so that the committees can see what the updates do and take informed decisions in that regard. Local government equitable share formula, in terms of its structure, it's being reviewed to improve its targeting towards poorly resourced places. And of course, to the extent that there will be a need to phase in the impact of the changes, all formulae will be implemented on a phased basis so that the shock is not too huge for the places that may lose resources to bear. Kialebo.
Director General, sorry, for the presentation, honourable members, there you have it. We're going to take the questions on the whole presentation as is how I'm informed now. But the Secretariat will deal with the separate minutes as they know how to do.
Yeah. Thanks, Co-Chair. We'll note hands and then you'll. But I just wanted to indicate the Minister and Deputy Minister in particular. I was just consulting with the co-chairs on the other side. As you know, and I think the Deputy Minister will know better, because I don't know whether I should say he is the grandfather of this act. If I say the father, that's. No, I wanted to modify it so that he doesn't take care of me, he doesn't take the responsibility of giving birth to Siamese twins on both sides, two sets of Siamese twins, because there's Siamese twins there, but another set of Siamese twins here. Now, practically and ideally, in fact, we should be actually separating the deliberations, but we have agreed amongst ourselves that if there are further issues on appropriations, National Treasurer will avail itself for further interrogation. So for now, we should not have Chinese walls. And let's deal with the issues as one presentation, and the Secretariat will find a way to deal with the issues. Over to you, Co-Chair.
Let's take your hands. Let's start here in the inner circle. On the leaves. Good North. Number two, I'm going to give you a number. Swart number one, starting there with Swart number two. Yes, I've got your hand. Mr. Rocha. Mr. Harris got more grayer in the National Assembly. Hands here, one for Chani, one for Makubela. Down at the back row. Provinces. Sogoni. Sogoni. Anyone I missed? In that order?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the DG and the Minister for their presentations. Very, very encouraging, really, and so any comments and questions should be taken in that light. The question of the contingency. The narrative is that the expenditure is being held constant, whereas in fact, when one does a budget, a contingency is never meant to be spent. It's a contingency. So, in reality, we are now taking the contingency and we're putting it into expenditure. And we're saying that, therefore, the expenditure hasn't increased. I would argue that, in fact, it has increased because of the fact that I've mentioned that a contingency is if possible, if one doing a budget, you should really, the slush fund, and one should not have slush funds and budgets. But what reaction to that? The DG has made some comments throughout the presentation regarding the return of confidence of investors over the short and medium term. What gives us that kind of good feeling that that's going to happen? What's going to cause that kind of confidence to change? What are the factors that are going to imply on to cause that? You know, we talk about the supply of electricity being sorted out, and indeed it is, but the cost of electricity has rocketed, and so that's not going to change. As an example, and you used it in terms of your presentation. I'm curious about the rollovers. There's a figure of $1.5 billion as an additional appropriation in rollovers. Now, does that include funding that was already transferred to other spheres of government but was not used? Or is this funding that was never transferred and now will be transferred? As we know that over the past year there's been fiscal dumping, where money's been dumped in other spheres of government, particularly into local government and in things like housing. So I'm curious to know that $1.5 billion. I assume that's money out of national treasury, I mean, that's the obvious answer. But if that is the obvious answer, do we know then how much the rollover is that was already transferred in the previous financial year? Mr. Chairman, the question of conditional grants is one that my colleagues and I discussed yesterday, and it's a point I think there's fairly universal view on the question of post-construction maintenance and the lack of funding, particularly at local government level, to be able to maintain the infrastructure which we quite rightly are putting a great deal of emphasis on. And I was wondering whether the Minister had any views on how that maintenance burden is planned to be handled. Mr. Chairman, I take the Minister's point about working together, but Mr. Minister, that doesn't mean slavishly following a particular viewpoint. And if we're going to work together, then one has to listen to other people and take some good points from them as well. So I think the point you're making is a good point, but perhaps we have some good points, and perhaps my colleague Tim will raise one of his pet ones in his questions. No, he hasn't. It's a caucus position. No, it's not, Mr. Chairman.
Well, there, just carry on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your protection from the Minister. Mr. Chairman, in closing, I'm rather pleased that the Protection of State Information Bill has yet to be enacted, because I see before me a secret document, and if the bill had been enacted, I would be running around trying to find a police station or someone else to hand it back to. So thank you for those of you who have delayed the enactment of that bill.
Honourable Minister?
Point of before. Yeah, it's an unusual meeting procedure. Just on the secret bit, that was accidentally put there. So can you please all lift your pens now and cross it out? Thank you very much. We'll come back to the good points.
Yeah, that's how we work in Budget Council too.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Minister, there are no bottles of wine coming this way. The Speaker is overseas, so I haven't had a call from him with regard to that. If I had a choice, I would have given you a cognac. Of course, I think you're going to need that to keep to your baseline of 2012. So congratulations with a very, very good speech of yesterday.
Good enough, you used the same words in February. You owe us also.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't care. I know I've got no doubt he is one of the good ministers in Cabinet. Yesterday in the statement, you've made the remark that consumer indebtedness stands at 76% of gross disposable income. Now, we've heard that the unsecured loans stands at a record level of $384 billion in South Africa now, and that there are some commentators that fear a bubble. Now, can I ask, if you look at that CPI inflation for food is at 9%, percentage of GDP of private debt is probably in South Africa, I haven't got the exact figure, over 100%. You've also in the USA it's about 160%. I don't know what's the figure of percentage of GDP of private debt in this country. When can we expect the financial sector regulator to make some announcements on this issue? And then just secondly, I was privy to Chief Economist presentation of the Bank of Austria. And it's clearly that Europe is doing whatever they can do, and they really think that Europe will slightly move out of their problems during 2030. Their major concern is the United States of America. Maybe your views on that, whether you are a little bit more positive about Europe, and that can be good news for us towards the end of 2030.
Well, Steve Swart?
The handsomer Swart. The younger, Swart the younger. Minister, thank you. Just from our side, Napoleon once said, leaders are dealers in hope. And I think yesterday you did indeed bring a lot of hope to the nation. Yes, Napoleon Gordon. And we indicated our broad support for the medium-term budget. What was... Not building empires. What was very impressive was the fact that the budget deficit only came in at 0.2% higher than what was forecast. A lot of people were expecting it to come in much higher. And I think it does indicate that the fiscal consolidation path is on track. The question then is, why are we not attracting foreign direct investment? Why has that decreased during the year? Is it due to other domestic challenges such as the mining strike, the concerns around the mining, and how do we address that? Secondly, again, when one looks at the reduction in the deficit, it is encouraging, but the outer year now, where you're looking at a figure of 1.7 trillion rand, it seems an enormous figure, and you indicated very strongly yesterday this will be paid. Now, whilst your deficit is decreasing, which is very positive, but it's like a snowball that's getting bigger, how is that going to be paid in the longer term? And then lastly, the more contentious issue, which you might fall back on the sub judice rule, and it is probably more of a budget item, but the issue of SANRAL, that the announcement that was made yesterday, and the funding model, depending, of course, what the review court says in November, do you expect that there might be additional requirements over the medium term to fund SANRAL? And was it not premature to announce to go ahead with the project, considering that there is that review court still to be heard? Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Marius, now the handsome SWAT. Thanks, Chair. Thank you for the presentation.
Minister, thank you for the restraint shown in the budget, and I think it's to be welcomed, and especially the move towards infrastructure spending, because that is where jobs will be created. And I think job creation is absolutely important for South Africa at the moment. But what is the worrying factor is that, you know, we still find huge under-expenditure by departments. At the end of the fourth quarter of last year, our under-expenditure was 11.4 billion by government departments. Now, it's a growing figure. It becomes bigger every year, and it's huge. I know it's a very small percentage, but it's big in monetary terms. The situation, for instance, if we come back to job creation, is that one of the areas in which we're going to use for job creation purposes is the EPWP funds. And I see that there's going to be additional funding for EPWP. What is worrying about this is that, for instance, municipalities in the previous financial year only spent 54.5% of their allocation for EPWP funds. And are there any plans underfoot to make sure that these funds and generally expenditure is controlled much better?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, noticing this slide on the decline in business confidence, which is quite concerning, and the important role that business will play in the implementation of the infrastructure build program. Is there any follow-up plans to engage with business? And if my memory serves me right, a year ago, business indicated through BUSA that they are able and willing to assist government in terms of the infrastructure build program and that they are ready for interaction. It seems that the interaction with business is to a certain extent, and may I use the word slow, and will we see an acceleration in terms of involvement with business as soon as possible? Chairperson, the also the remark by the Minister in terms of that we should be involved in, to ensure that state public funds are spent efficiently at other levels of government. Is there any plans with regards perhaps to our committee and monitoring assistance that we can give from National Treasury? If I can take an example, we welcome the intervention by Treasury in terms of Section 2162 of the Constitution, where the funds of municipalities are somehow monitored in terms of the DORA allocations, and those are the measures that we support. And we would like to congratulate Treasury with interventions to ensure that the monies are spent and that we get value for our rand at this level of government, especially at the local level of government. But what plans do we have in terms of proper coordination and with local government in terms of setting up committees to ensure that National Treasury is fully involved and that we can strengthen this? And will the procurement office or officer, I'm not sure whether it's going to be the establishment of an office or will it just be an officer at national level, and what is the progress with regards to the to this office in terms of helping us to ensure that we have efficiency in spending? Thank you.
On Mofa Royan, did you raise your hand? Then I apologize for not noting it. You may pose your question.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also start by welcoming the presentation. Chair, I think I've got only two issues. Maybe the first one might be a question in the form of a comment. I've realized that notwithstanding the fact that we are all in agreement that innovation is a key lever of our development agenda. I've realized that in our consolidated expenditure, science and technology is recording the lowest annual average annual growth. Albeit it's a growing one, but it's the lowest among the rest. I'm not sure if are there any prospects of maybe dealing with this differently? Because from where I am, I think this is one area that I think if we can improve, our development can definitely, and growth can definitely take a different trajectory. I'd also share, just as a comment, I mean, from where I am, I think it would be very interesting to to comprehend maybe exactly. I know some of the causes have been thoroughly advocated as to why some reallocation as a result of fund expenditure. But the impact of these reallocations, because as we take money from some of these projects and reallocate these provisions to other projects, it definitely doesn't say service delivery that was meant, I mean, to be rendered is compromised. So I think at some stage, really, we need to maybe do a thorough analysis as to the impact of these reallocation processes, as much as it's a welcome initiative. But I think it will be also important for us to know how is it impacting on our overall service delivery program. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Roy, Honorable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. The Minister asked me to publicly say well done on the record, so I will say that. But last year he invited me for tea, Chair, and the invitation hasn't landed in my pigeonhole yet. So if I don't get that, perhaps I might not be saying well done in February. I'm saying well done because of the important signal that the spending freeze sent. I'm wondering, has there ever been an MCBPS where we haven't adjusted spending up? But I think the Honourable Lees did cover the role of the contingency reserve in achieving that. I mean, I think there is definitely some fiscal sleight of hand involved there. Also, I'm interested in the fact that you're counting on 3.5 billion rand of underspending. Now, I accept the 3 billion of savings. That's legitimate. But, I mean, you're actually depending on departments not to spend their budgets. That's combining that with the contingency reserve, I think, actually probably gives lie to the fact that we are imposing a spending freeze. And then just in that regard, on page 22 of the presentation, that in-year adjustments table is very, very useful. It took us about an hour in the lockup to work it out yesterday. So if you could please include it in the documents going for the MCBPS going forward, it would be very, very helpful. Chair, my overall impression from this budget is the Treasury has control of the finances. They've sent a very important signal in that regard. Obviously, there's questions about public sector wages and wasteful expenditure, but overall, Treasury is in charge of finances. What I see, however, is the Treasury is not in charge of policy implementation. Every budget, we hear the same stories from National Treasury. This year, they talk about active labor market policies, which is a euphemism for the youth wage subsidy. They talk about reducing the cost of regulatory compliance for SMEs, removing trade barriers. What is the mechanism for Treasury to get these ideas passed? I mean, they actually depend on other departments, by and large. And it's certainly getting frustrating for me in the short time that I've been in Parliament to see the Minister make these commitments every single budget, and then nothing happens in the months between then and the next budget. The only way to tackle a crisis level of unemployment, which we do have, is through these microeconomic reforms. The Minister knows what to do, but nothing ever comes out of this government in terms of practical implementation. Clearly, allocating money to projects like the youth wage subsidy just doesn't work. I mean, you did that 2.5 years ago. They got 5 billion rand for that project. It hasn't appeared yet. Something is broken in the system if Treasury can't get its way on policy. Then everybody's welcomed this budget, which represents belt tightening, and I think South Africa is relieved to see it, but there's a deep cynicism out there about the fact that we can spend 200 million rand on the president's compound in KwaZulu-Natal. And Minister, I don't think you can simply kick this question to the Public Works Minister. You play the main role in allocating funds and approving spending. You do have to keep accounting to what you said in the beginning. And I think you have to account on this number. In particular, more broadly, how do you see this budget propping up the president in his in the rest of his term? Because certainly these kinds of questions are what I see leading to a potential tax revolt by South African taxpayers. While we continue to spend money like 200 million rand on what appears to be a deeply personal project for the president, I think you're going to see start seeing taxpayers losing faith in the spending side of the tax that they're paying. At the DA, we were very pleased to hear you reference the new growth path only twice in the document, and the National Development Plan 14 times. We take that as a very important signal. we acknowledge your commitment to putting the National Development Plan into the budget going forward. To what extent will that plan appear in February? I mean, is the objective to incorporate all of the programs and ideas in the National Development Plan into the budgets going forward? And then, Chair, I really battle to get a handle on infrastructure spending. The numbers are massive, and it's very difficult to understand exactly how much is being spent at the end of the day. The problem for me is that the construction companies, of which we have several, they're all rather large companies, they're all globally competitive, and they all keep reporting really bad annual results. Surely if we're spending this much on infrastructure, that should start showing in the construction companies' annual reports. Why is that not there? That makes me question whether this infrastructure spending is actually taking place. Then, Chair, the Minister committed to taking a more deliberate approach to managing overall employment in the public sector and curtailing growth in the personal numbers. It's on page 26 of the MTBPS. How do you make that happen, Minister? How do you bring down the numbers of government employees? What is the mechanism? Or is it similar to your policy reforms, just something that you recommend that you hope might happen? And lastly, Chair, I see that the Minister talks about administered prices going up 10% last year, but I don't see any proposals in the budget to try and moderate that going forward. It's a seriously alarming number that's seriously inflationary, and we're going to need to start moderating that. The budget has a direct role to play in setting administered prices, but I certainly wasn't satisfied by what I read yesterday. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Harris. Honourable Shigoni.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. I was just wondering, I heard Honourable Harris commending the minister, and then he had an afterthought that he might lose his job as a leader of the GA, as a shadow minister of the GA in finance, then decided to come up with, invent some questions just to save his job. Well, I think it's a good strategy for him to retain his job, that chairperson. I think that now we also welcome, it's a good thing that all the parties are agreed that under the circumstances this is a good MTBPS. But I think that as other colleagues have raised that maybe there are some of the issues that needs to be accelerated. One of them, as it was indicated at the beginning of the year, the establishment of this procurement of office. I think that as the ANC would really like to encourage National Treasury to accelerate the establishment of that office. And secondly, the other issue that we always harp on, but I'm not sure where the blockages are, the issue of beneficiation, which we all agree that it can contribute towards the creation of employment, but there seems to be difficulties in ensuring that we also accelerate this beneficiation. The other question, Chairperson, is the job facilitation fund. The job facilitation fund, the minister reported yesterday that there has been 1.8 billion. We had a meeting with DBSA and the past few days. We just want to, we hope that now this fund or the managers of this fund have really found their ground in ensuring that it can be accelerated on administrative to ensure that it produces what it was intended for. Or in other words, checking up the expenditure on that. It's a bit slow, as you know. But the other question, Chairperson, is related to some of the rollovers. You know, the rollovers that are there. Well, I'm sure that at the end of the day, we'll engage with the responsible department. But I'm not sure, or I guess that National Trust is aware that these rollovers, especially that are here, they are not coming for the first time. They are not coming for the second time. Could be for the third time. But the same, exactly the same article, a rollover. And the Public Finance Management Act is weary of the situation of rolling over over and over for the same reasons, because it's a bad reflection on those departments. The other issue, Chairperson, that is mentioned, is an issue which I think that most of the colleagues have mentioned, the infrastructure, around infrastructure expenditure. I think that the resources are there, are enough. But the issue is around the implementation of the expenditure. You know, I like the division of revenue. Division of revenue is very clear. It says in order for a department that is going to implement infrastructure program or a project to be approved, it requires clear plans. But the appropriation bill, the appropriation does not require that same, what you call a plan. I think that as appropriation, we would like to ensure that clause also goes to appropriation. Because there are national departments, many of them, they implement the infrastructure project. And in fact, if you look at the rollovers, it's some of them that are not spending. And to us, it looks like it's just the planning that is the issue. So we will propose that then we have that clause in the next appropriation bill. But the just the last one, is the there has been what you call the strikes before. I mean, there's a season for strikes. I think all over the world there's a season for strikes. But this year, it looks like the unions, especially in the mining industry, had upped their act to the extent that it required mention by the minister of this. But how do we in future ensure that I know that it's not in the ambit of the national treasurer. It's other people, but how do we assist to ensure that it does not happen in future? Not that there won't be strikes in future, there will be strikes, but that there's some kind of management which has resulted this year to some negative issues that the minister has raised. Chairperson, for now, I'm sure other colleagues will take up on some of the issues that the last one, checklist, I must raise. No, I'm sitting this side today again. The last one, Chairperson, is about the savings. You see, I think we appreciate that there are savings and what, but the worry from the reports that we get, especially from your Section 32 report, we find that many of the programs could not be implemented because people do not have the requisite personnel. And many of those vacancies are funded vacancies, but they are not employed. People are not employing. The president at the State of the Nation address, I think it was 2011 or so, had made a call to the department to employ where there are funded vacancies, but it is not happening. Is National Treasury also going to encourage the department to ensure that they employ now, especially for those critical, what we call the posts? Because some of them, they come and say, no, there's a moratorium or something. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Omshogoni. He's got a long breath. Honorable Chani and then Honorable Makubela. Who's covered? Chairperson, thank you. Makubela.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm also covered, partly covered, but when reading this document, the Director General, you stated well, some of the challenging environment of continued economic uncertainty, you know, it's very much uncertain. You see, as Honorable Marzogoni said, the strikes on the mine all over. And you also said that the rand is shaking, you know. How will you ensure that the investors, whom you are saying that some are stopping to continue with the investment, some are withdrawing, while understanding the speech of the minister yesterday, it tried to encourage people to come back. But now, as this thing is happening, what is your strategy to cool them down again? Because you also indicated that some are stopping, some are withdrawing. What is the strategy, man, to use in order to have our rand stabilizing, have a nice shot? Thanks.
Well, Makubela, I noted the hand there. Just introduce yourself.
Well, thanks, Chair. I'm Mogeni Khadebe from Gauteng Legislature. I want to add on the comment the Minister for the speech yesterday. And I think the point around the spending in provinces, I think it was a good point to be made. I think we have a problem there. One example in Gauteng where the Zola Hospital, which was supposed to be done for 300 million, ended up being done for about 888 million, which is three times the amount. And the problems with that aspect as well. One of the ideas that Member Sogoni spoke about the procurement office, I think something that is happening in Canada, Ontario, the issue of ensuring that the tendering process, whilst we know it's an open tender process, becomes very open. People get confidence that that process is clean and is not corrupt. to the people around how we use money as government. I wanted to ask a question around the central issues as well. I think for me the comment is that we must not close ourselves to those kind of options. I think the mistake is that as parties we put ourselves in corners and close ourselves to those kind of options. Whilst we know that a lot of money in terms of finance will go to the social sectors, for the other projects we'll need public-private partnerships and we need to support that going forward in terms of infrastructure expansion in the country. But I want to hear your comment around that. The issue of Gautrain, I think there's something mentioned in the report about Gautrain, the issue of ridership guarantees as part of the contracts of Gautrain. And I think since the project has been completed, the number of people using Gautrain has gone up. Should we expect those allocations to Gautrain to go down in the province because around those sources of ridership guarantees? Three, the issue of EPWP, I'm happy to see more money being going to that side. I don't know if we're doing well in terms of spending around EPWP. And I think I'm happy with the innovation of giving some of the money to NGO sector so that it's not limited only to government using money on EPWP. So I think for me that's a good innovation. I don't see the spending on agriculture sector. And for me it's one of the concerns because those are some of the labor intensity sectors that we need to be supporting. If we're having problems around mining and we'll have problems going forward, what other sectors can assist us to ensure that we absorb people that deal with the levels of unemployment? And for me, agriculture is one of those sectors that needs to be supported very, very highly. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Member Swart is gone, but I was going to say that he said he's handsome. He's to the eyes of the beholder, like beauty.
Well, he's looking into your eyes. The last one there. Introduce yourself.
Thanks, Chair. I'm Sakiwe Khumalo from Gauteng, the Chairperson of Finance. Chair, on page, on slide 19, on the 250 billion that has been set aside for financing viable projects, given the lack of capacity in relation to project management. That is a comment, just to say it will be important. In relation to what Member Khadebe and Member Sogon was saying, that it will be important that we tighten capacity in the public sector in relation to ensuring that implementation of such projects are realized. I think it will be important that we tighten that at the public sector level. Taking into account also that the minister say they gave hope to the country and to our people. But taking into account the recent developments in relation to the poor borrowing ratings, it will be important just to check whether we will be in a position to realize foreign direct investment, and also are there any other any concrete plans in relation to these developments?
Thank you, Honourable Members, for the questions. Before I forget, we recognize the presence of the Acting Chair of the FSC. Mr. Khumalo, welcome, with the rest of your team that are here. Honourable Members, we, as Select Committee for Finance, paid a visit to Limpopo, and what happened there, that we were briefed that there was they were doing a head count on the officials working in the education department in the province, in health. That's what I want to put to National Treasury to do the same in all the other provinces. to cut on the spending that is not being used usefully. So that recipe is starting to work. We were there. There's still a lot to be done, but it's a way to go, a route to take. Thank you for your questions, Honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, and your team. You want to say something?
Just as you acknowledged the chair of the FFC, Bongani, I just wanted to indicate that we also have in our midst the minister's principal. The minister in our midst today, we have honorable members, we have the Mrs. Gordon. She's present in the amongst us.
Good.
Don't look this way and that way. I just wanted to say you must be aware that we also have the support base for the minister here. And I wish to acknowledge you, Ms. Gordon, and on his behalf also continue to thank you for the support. Thank you. Over to you, Minister.
No, that is power sharing. Oh, Minister.
Thanks, Chairperson and honorable members. The Minister has decided to delegate part of the opening a response to if he's got a principal, I don't know what to call the Deputy Minister. The first question that Mr. Lees asked is with regards to the contingency reserve, and he thinks it's not appropriate to count the contingency reserve in or to include it in expenditure because by its nature it should not be included. If we go to page 37, you will realize that for what the adjustments are for. It is there up to a point when it is allocated, if it has to be allocated. And as a result, and as situation would dictate, it has now been allocated. Because of, as you have correctly pointed out, because of the higher than expected wage settlements and all the other expenditure that has come. And that is what it is for. It has since been allocated, and if you look at page 37, in 2012-13, we then no longer have it. But then again, 2013-14, we again create a line for the contingency reserve. 4 billion in the first 10 and 30, we have another 44 in the medium-term expenditure frame. So I would imagine that that is the most appropriate way of handling it. So you do have your contingency reserve, but the contingency reserve has done precisely what you also agree that it is also supposed to do. I will also allow the minister to continue and deal with the others, but let me then handle, as per my delegation, the questions on infrastructure spending. The first one I picked up was asked by Mr. Swart. I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's the handsome one or the younger one. But it was with regards to under expenditure allocations to infrastructure, but we are confronted with these levels of under expenditure. You'll see that there is an improvement. If you look at the statement itself, you will see that we have seen some marked improvement in infrastructure expenditure, though not to the level that we would want it to be. So the difficulty with infrastructure, and one is now some experience having gone into it, and Des correctly points out that when you when you reallocate funding from infrastructure, you compromise service delivery. But I think service delivery is more compromised when it is not taking place when there are funds allocated to it. So why keep funds where they are not being spent? So there are two approaches to it, and that is why our approach is that one of ensuring that underperforming programs and projects are assisted to perform. An example is the one, and perhaps appropriations and select committee will bear with me and agree with me that the ACD program in the Eastern Cape has faltered because what we have found was that, one, the capacity we are talking about, but we can't continue talking about this capacity and not do anything about it. And with the DBSA assisting in project management, a number of lessons have been learned. In most of our rural areas, what you find is that the capacity to deliver on infrastructure is also impacted upon by the lack of other infrastructure that will enable you to get there. In some schools, you can't start building the schools because there is no road that leads to the school. And when you get to a school, you cannot, when you begin the project, you cannot build the school because the material to build the school is not available in the area. When it is available, the quality is not the quality that would actually meet the standards. But that does not mean that the contractors themselves, as Mr. Harris, as the shop steward of the contractors, has raised the issue that he doesn't believe that this infrastructure is delivering because the contractors are not recording attractive numbers. But the contractors that we have met with that were supposed to deliver this infrastructure, I don't think they would want to be in a meeting again with us. Because for the first time, we have started actually to make sure that there are consequences for the contractors that are given the work at the price that they have quoted but are not able to deliver. Because having said that, there might be those challenges in those areas, but also the contractors themselves, some of them have actually not lived up to the standard that they have actually committed themselves to. So we actually need to wield the oversight mechanism that the chairperson is talking about, make sure that the service providers do what they're supposed to do, make sure that the our oversight is working in those areas, and where there are penalties that need to be, because those are city programs, all of them are behind time. And we have said that the penalties must kick in. We can't have those penalties, and when the time comes to invoke those, they don't happen. So I think the next meeting we're going to have with the contractors will be when they will be handing over the projects, and I would want to urge the committees that do oversight to actually visit those areas when they have delivered behind time, but also we need to see the scars on them that they have endured as a result of late delivery. But the lessons we have learned are the lessons we must actually build on, and I think some of the institutions like the DBSA are now wiser than they were when we went in for the first time and were not able to live up to our commitments. So the involvement of business infrastructure, the 840, we're talking about the 250 in the first year, with the bulk of it being in the SOEs. I think that's the area where that capacity we are talking about is actually there. In the SOEs, we do have that capacity, so the 250 billion, more than 60% of the 250 billion and the 844 over the medium term is actually in the SOEs, and at least there is capacity in the SOEs. But again, there will be at times those delays that will be beyond our controls. But again, the issue of oversight becomes very critical, not only with the implementing agents, but also at the level of some of the committees in legislatures and parliament. Minister, I'll wait for further instructions and delegations.
You have a very loyal team. You see. Just wait for further instructions. I am so indebted to you. Let me go back, Chairperson, to Mr. Lee's question. I thought he made a rather unfortunate and derogatory reference to slush funds. I think we must be very, very careful. The National Treasury, and therefore this government, has been number one in budget transparency for 2 years running, and in the top two or three for years now. This is not a slush fund. Let's be absolutely clear about that. We come back to you as Parliament each time. 1 cent needs to move in these numbers. Slush funds are secret allocations. Now, there is such a fund in defense that somebody looks at, the Auditor General takes care of that, the such a fund in intelligence, and the Auditor General takes care of that. The contingency reserve is not a slush fund. I hope the journalists are awake, and I hope they're writing it down clearly and emphatically as well. So it's a rather unfortunate reference, Mr. Lees. This is a transparent process. You can never anticipate every event. Take the floods in the Eastern Cape now. Right? And there are floods or tornadoes or similar events that happen every year in one or other province in the country. We can't anticipate the exact numbers of those. Wage negotiations are also very similar to that. Or there might be government programs, but every single thing comes back to you for your approval as Parliament. You have the right in the Assembly as the chairperson to know to say we disagree, and you do as the DA. You make it a sport. You know, I object, record my statement, record my objection, call a division, wait for us to come and vote, and so on and so on. Those are all transparent democratic processes that you exercise your rights as the DA on regularly. And it's for them, we'll see it again, I suppose, next year or even on these questions when they actually come up. So I thought I needed to intervene on that. On the question of confidence and investors, there are different types of investors. Firstly, there are people who invest on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. Now, if you look at the worldwide trends, and it's a pity, Chairperson, we will still make available to you the reports we had from the IMF in particular 2 weekends ago in Tokyo. Now, generally across the world, there's lots of uncertainty on the stock markets. And more money is leaving stock markets than entering stock markets when we last heard from the IMF. So that's equity investors. Secondly, he's the expert on, and the one behind him, on bond investors. Now, at the moment, when I last heard, there's no problem with bond investors and trading in South Africa. In fact, we're doing excellently. I don't know what the latest numbers are. Is it today? What did you go out? What did you offer? So this week, I'm just checking. My apologies, chairpersons. We went out to borrow $2.1 billion. And it was oversubscribed. That means there are more people willing to buy our bonds than the bonds we needed to actually offer. So there's confidence still, notwithstanding all of the things we do and say in South Africa in the bond markets. The third element is foreign direct investment, as in bricks and mortar. And there you have some things happening, like Walmart, despite all the difficulties we've had, but it's definitely here, they're in South Africa. Every day you would actually hear about investors buying one or other business in South Africa. Is it happening on the scale that we would like? Not yet. Do we need to do more to sell ourselves as South Africa? We do. And that is why in as many fora as possible, including yesterday, I'm saying to all of us, put national interest first. Put party political point scoring second, right? So that we can talk up South Africa. You can't shoot South Africa in the foot when it suits you politically and then say, why is FBI not coming here? I met, for example, about 15 or 16, and my colleagues were with me, the DG and the Deputy Minister, CEOs of Indian companies about 10 days ago. And they're regularly coming to South Africa, looking for opportunities, trying to work out how they use the facilities we have, both to invest in South Africa and to use South Africa as a, a launching pad for their operations in Africa as well. More and more entities are setting up their head offices in South Africa. Now the question is, how do we encourage that more? And clearly, we need to have a more stable political climate in South Africa, and of course, in the current context, we need to have a calmer industrial climate. The labor relations process is beginning to work again. As you saw over the last few days, unions and employers have been sitting around the table, they've been signing agreements, and they're trying to reinforce the notion that labor disputes are to be resolved within the labor relations system, and that there are channels of communication that workers have. Those channels have been disrupted in the past few weeks, but what we should complement, all of us should complement the employers and the trade unions for, is trying to rebuild the system and rebuild confidence in that system. And as we do that, we rebuild confidence in our country as well. So I mean, several colleagues have raised that particular question, and we have to work harder. We have to work as a team in that regard as well. Mr. Lee says, you know, they have some good points. I'm willing to listen. I haven't seen them yet. So, you know, the tea invitation will certainly be issued. Each time I'm about to issue it, I see some point scoring happening. And then I hesitate now. Is it going to be worth the tea and the cost of the tea? But don't worry. We'll set it up and let's see if we can get the constructive dialogue the country needs at this point in time. There's issues about supply and cost of electricity. Here again, Chairperson, we would like your guidance. How can we get a evidence-based discussion going, which says, you see, here's the backlog we have in terms of electricity generation. Here's the capital cost of getting that generation capacity going and the transmission capacity going, and the connections that need to be still made between households and electricity supplies in many parts of our country. How do we, within our current fiscal environment and the anticipated environment, how do we afford all of these things? Who pays for them? What are the different options available? And which options do we want to exercise? Otherwise, we so easily go to the cost factor and say it's unaffordable. But we have to make choices. If we say government give Eskom more money, then somebody and some program is going to have less money because we've set the bar in terms of the amount of money we have within our reach. We don't have the time now to go into all of the detail. The Director General or others might want to add, but those are some of the tough choices we need to make. The rollovers question that the DG will handle in a moment. Like Mr. Lees, we also don't want to see fiscal dumping. And it's a practice that we need to discourage. I think we've gone some way towards that, but not entirely. There's still, I suspect, some of that is actually happening. And the other point around post-construction maintenance, he will handle as well. Mr. Kornoff, your figure about consumer indebtedness at 76%, we've just confirmed, is what the quarterly bulletin of the Reserve Bank states. Do we have a bubble in terms of unsecured loans? We don't have a bubble, but there is a series of worrying signs, and we'll be making some announcements in this regard on Monday. So if you don't mind, I won't go further on that right now. Europe and the U.S., now, so it's interesting, you met some people based in Europe, and they're going to point the finger at the U.S. You meet some U.S. people, they're going to point the fingers the other way. Whether we like it or not, and when we do that broader presentation for you in terms of what the IMF is saying, nobody is seeing light through the tunnel yet at that level in terms of what's happening in the global economy. And each country has had its own political gridlocks, and each region has its own political gridlocks. If you think we're badly off, look at some of them and the amount of time it's taking to actually take what appeared from here to be very simple decisions. Do you want to bail out your banks or don't you? Do you want to capitalize your banks or don't you? Do you want to buy Spain's bonds or don't you through the central bank? And, you know, the size of the stability mechanism adequate or not adequate? What are the conditionalities that Spain or anybody will have to abide by if they're going to apply for any so-called bailout or assistance in that particular environment? And so I think what we now realize is that Europe has now set up what are called medium-term safety nets in terms of a European regulator, possibly a so-called banking union, the stability mechanism, some kind of movement towards a fiscal union. But you can also see that there are serious questions being raised about sovereignty. In other words, is somebody sitting in Brussels going to dictate to somebody sitting elsewhere in Europe about what deficits they're going to have and how they're going to reduce their deficits? And those are fascinating democratic challenges in that particular environment. So in the near term, there's still, I think, a leadership deficit within multilateral fora. And there are still extremely worrying times. And when we do show you the IMF material, you'll see the amount of hard work that needs to be done in some parts of the world in order to get stability within those environments. But if you've seen some light that we haven't seen yet, good luck on that one. Mr. Swart, on the fact that consolidation is on track. Remember that consolidation is being, if you like, pushed back a bit because of both the global environment and our own domestic environment. So the sooner we get back to growth, the sooner we start raising revenue, the sooner we can actually reduce the deficit faster and begin to build up fiscal space, which is what we had in 2008, 2009, to respond to the recession that came to our shores. The DG will handle the rest of your questions. Mr. Ross, I've addressed your business confidence issue. There is, in fact, more dialogue happening between government and business. The President's convening of the summit of business and labor with government and community was a very important step. Two meetings have happened. There's progress, I think, that you'll see emerging from that process as well. Last week, the Infrastructure Commission convened a meeting between business, labor, and government again. Most of the top construction companies were there. They were encouraged by what they saw. And that graph that you saw that the Director General was pointing to you early on, the bar chart, about where the projects are necessary steps that we need to go through. You can't just dive into a multi-billion run project and say start implementing tomorrow without planning carefully, without doing the necessary financial calculations that we need to do, and all of that is proceeding. And remember, it'll look pretty slow now, but once we get the whole engine moving and the pipeline starts moving, hopefully we won't have any gaps within this environment as well. I think Mr. Harris asked a similar question. On the Section 216, Mr. Brown will address that question. On the Chief Procurement Office and Officer, we hope to make appointments here before the end of the year. Advertisements took place, applications have come in. We will hopefully in the course of the next week do the necessary interviews and see whether we have the right quality of people that we require and then get the kind of technology work that we need to move forward. Mr. Van Rooyen's question, Mr. Donaldson will respond to. Then on the contingency reserve, and again, we have rather unfortunate language from Mr. Harris about my neighbor is saying that's another caucus position, Chairperson. To now throw a shadow of doubt and make it look like we're manipulating numbers. Now, we're not manipulating numbers. The numbers are there. We're saying that the gross expenditure will remain at the same level, as we said in the 2012 budget. The gross expenditure is at that level. Now, if you don't understand something, please have the humility to ask first before making accusations about what we're doing. Right? And that's the only courtesy I ask for. If after that there needs to be a criticism offered, offer the criticism. But ask first so that you understand the same things we understand out of the numbers, but we'll respond to that in a moment. The page 22 you're referring to, we're confused by, probably page 36 is the one you're referring to. So there are numbers there on that page. You make a valid point. We are in control of finances. No treasury in the world is responsible for implementing energy policy or water policy or rural policy or agriculture policy. Those are the responsibilities of the various departments. And as a committee on finance, if you see it appropriate to request ministers or directors general from those departments to come to you and explain what they're doing and how they're doing it, that's within your power, and it's not for me to interfere in that process. So it is true. Our job is to allocate money, and the point that has been rapidly made, I think, was it by yourself? No, Mr. Makubula. Makubela. No, where is Mr. Makubela? Where is this? Well, one of you, honorable colleagues, on DORA, that's Mr. Sogoni's point, that DORA has the necessity for clear plans, and shouldn't the appropriations bill process and bill require that? I think that's an excellent idea. And you should put it into your recommendations to the executive, and let's see how we can actually implement it so that we don't talk in generalities about these questions. And you as the ANC can defend yourself to the DA when they accuse your ANC department, plans of not being delivered. It'll help you as well. So I think, Mr. Harris, you make a fair point on implementation. And we would share your concern that we need to have, as other colleagues have also pointed out, more assertive and urgency in terms of implementation. The same issues arise around microeconomic reforms. We want to paint a picture to you and to the South African public of what we think needs to be done and what government thinks needs to be done in order to move our economy forward. So if red tape needs to be reduced and is not reduced adequately, up to this point in time, we will say so. And those who are responsible must go and do the things that they actually need to do to place the country in the right kind of position. But we would agree that macroeconomic reforms in South Africa are absolutely crucial. Again, you use regrettable language in reference to the president. I think the office of the president should be respected. You can ask as many questions as you like. And to the extent that we have answers, we will give them. And if we don't have them, we'll tell you where to go to get them. So in the process of asking the question, let's respect the office and not use words like cropping up the president for the rest of his term, because with great respect, Chairperson, that doesn't help us to demonstrate respect for the office of the president. So on Inkandla. I've said this in other fora on the radio this morning. Let me repeat it here. I don't have the exact numbers. I have spoken to the Minister of Public Works. He himself has started some processes within his department. He's trying to get to the bottom of the costing before he comments too publicly so that he has more data available to him. I've indicated to him that once he has that, he should make that available so the rest of us know what is going on. And you are free to call the Minister of Public Works and request him to explain to you what the numbers are and what do they actually mean at this point in time. And again, to talk of a tax revolt by South Africans is rather unfortunate. I'm not sure whether, Mr. Lees, that's one of the good ideas that you were referring to. We've one of the most remarkable achievements of our democracy is to create the climate of tax compliance. And taxpayers should be absolutely vigilant that we, as politicians and as officials, spend their money well. And we're trying everything possible, certainly from where we are, to ensure that that actually happens. We know that there are still inadequacies in that regard. I'm not saying that we've arrived at a perfect pitch in this respect. And we would welcome some help from Parliament. Parliament has all the information it has that it needs. And calling for greater accountability by yourselves of the different entities where you think some of these things are happening will certainly assist us as well. So I leave it to the chairs of the Appropriations Committee or other committees to help us in this regard. I'm not sure whether you spent your time well, Mr. Harris, in counting the number of times the NDT or NGP is referred to. I'm sure you can make much better use of your time. In terms of the construction companies, I've responded to that question earlier on. Personnel numbers, we've indicated that what we have accepted is, if you like, where we've reached the compensation number as you have it. We've got agreement in government that we now need to look within those numbers, try to restrict certain types of employment. So we want to focus the limited resources that might be available on frontline service people. I think Deputy Minister Nene referred to this earlier on, but also start focusing a lot more, and we invite Parliament to join us in this. How much is spent on overtime in departments? Right? And what overspending is there on overtime? What are we spending on sick leave? People not at work, getting paid. Now, you hear all sorts of stories about people being away for a year and still getting paid. Who's managing that process? Should each department not come to you in Parliament and explain whether they have these phenomena actually taking place? Because those are the problems where leakages are happening within the compensation number. And like that, there are many other opportunities that we're beginning to look at and will intensify our efforts in this regard. On headwind prices, we've said we need to get some process going in government where we have better coordination of admin prices. So we agree we can't have different arms of the state going into different directions in this regard, and we are going to have consultations within government to see how we can manage this process. Let me pause for a while and let the Director General and other officials come in, and I'll try to conclude with the rest. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chairs and Honourable Members. Mr. Brown will also respond to the question about whether there are grants for financing maintenance of municipal infrastructure. The question about rollovers was asked by, I think, two Honourable Members, Mr. Lees and the Honourable Chair of the Appropriations Committee, Mr. Soko. I will tackle the sort of substance of the two questions at the same time. We try our utmost to make sure that the criteria we use in assessing what we recommend as rollovers meets quite strictly the rules that are prescribed in this regard. If there are instances, and I'm not saying any exist, but if there are instances where things have sort of edged into the gray area, it would only be because the circumstances that we face at the time are of such a nature that, you know, the decision is not a clear-cut one where we mustn't recommend this. I use recommend advisedly because the Treasury is not the final arbiter on this. Not even cabinet for that matter. To the extent that it may turn out that there is evidence that we have missed, which is less likely, I would submit that Parliament by all means still has the authority to say we don't agree with this one and chuck it out, or even ask us for the evidence which substantiates whether it is okay for a particular rollover to pass through the filter. I mean, national departments on the specifics now they don't keep cash. In other words, through their requisitions, they don't get cash and keep it in their banks. Then by the end of the year, the money is sitting in some accounts, and then they ask for rollovers. No. Their accounts get swept at predetermined intervals. So no money remains. When they ask for rollovers, it's only because the appropriation in the previous year had authorized them to spend up to a certain limit, but they fell within that limit. the conversations amongst us went back and forth, the amount kept decreasing every time, actually, to a smaller amount. Of the 1.5 billion, we are convinced that the things that we have recommended would fall more in the category of projects that would use the money. For provinces and local government, and you can see I use local government here, although it's not included in the additions insofar as all of us are concerned, we are guided in addition to everything else by the prescripts of the Division of Revenue Act, which now requires that monies that have not been used should be surrendered back, and then the process gets started to regularize those requests again. And I think that's enough on the fiscal dumping stuff. I mean, I think it may still exist, but now that people are aware that it's watched, the patterns have really changed. And it is for this reason that where we see non-performance, we stop the money. Now, on debt and its increase and how we will pay it. It's very important always to get the right context on this, because when the crisis befell us, we were in a very, very, very strong position in terms of our debt metrics. We were sitting in 2008 with a debt level of 426 billion, and it was falling. We were buying back debt because we were running surpluses, as if we knew that the crisis would come. And of course, some people would sort of notably say that when there is a contraction, most people are Keynesians. Most people agreed that when the crisis befell us, the right thing to do was not to slam brakes on expenditure, stop projects, lay off people, at the same time that all parts of the economy were doing that, in which case there would have been a bloodbath insofar as job shedding is concerned. So the just under a million could have turned out to be double that if government had joined in cutting it. So government had to support the economy, correctly so. And the deficit then rose to 6% in that year before starting to fall. But of course, with the problems of recovery sort of on and off, as a result of global and domestic circumstances, the consolidation process, or as some would put it, the switch from the support of the economy by government to the private sector, you know, having its demand rising because confidence and growth, are returning, is taking longer, which then does mean that for some time we may run deficits, continue to add to our total stock of debt. But what's critical here, which is why that we always draw attention of audiences to the fact that the deficit is set to drop over time, which means that the amount you add to your stock of debt every time gets smaller and smaller. And if your gross domestic product, which is the base you tax, expands, your ability to service that debt should increase because you have got a bigger tax base, more revenues, and therefore higher ability to afford that debt. The reason the market is less likely to lose any confidence anytime soon, unless things go terribly wrong one way or the other, and I don't see what could take things in that direction, it's because actively debt is being managed as we speak. Most people sometimes miss that it's not like all of this debt will be paid at some point into the future. Some bonds are maturing as we speak.
So the people who had invested in them are getting their money back. So they understand that the market works. You know, they because what we do is we take from one investor to pay the other, and the system works. And as long as the public, the investor community has confidence that the policies that are being pursued are sound, the economy will grow, the increases in debt will be managed, they will continue to buy our debt. It doesn't mean we should be complacent, because yes, there is talk of fiscal cliff, popular term these days, certainly in relation to the U.S., where things look like they're going normal, but all of a sudden when one or two things don't come together nicely, then things can collapse. you can have a difficulty with that, but the team that's led by Mr. Shumang, sitting behind me, if he's still here, you know, actively manages our debt to make sure that we reduce the refinancing risk, which means at any given time, in any given year, we will not have a huge amount that we've got to settle. They try to smooth it, to reduce it over time by buying the debt back and exchanging it for longer-term debt very early so that the market does not get jittery as we get close to that. And that's stuff that we can explain how we do it, the concept of switch options, but it's stuff that I don't want to get into details because I can get confused myself when I talk about it sometimes. Now, the Sunwell stuff, I think that, I mean, yesterday the minister read to the press the statement from cabinet that was issued after Wednesday, which signals that the process is now moving more towards the commencement of e-tolling after a very extensive consultation process, which saw what was initially intended to happen getting changed in ways that are very constructive for people who use the roads, more discounts, caps, and time of day savings, and a whole range of things, many of them which will be known when the tolls and the regulations are gazetted. In a context where there is now no legal impediment to tolling, it therefore stands to reason that government should consider starting tolling. I think it would be incorrect for government, when there is no such impediment, to then say let's put aside money, let's do this, and as if government believes that there is something wrong with the process that it went about to implement tolling. Because after two audits, which is what I'm told, I've not read this myself, after two audit processes, the processes that Sunrail went through were found to be very much in line with the rules as they pertain to this. As much as it became apparent that perhaps a slightly more open, prolonged consultation process, which includes some education, would work better, which is what has been done now, but the processes were found to be really in line with the process. So it is for that reason that there is no provision for funding for Sunder. Yes.
Just to interrupt, Chairperson, if you don't mind. On this particular question, I see now that there's a new tack, both from the DA and from OUTA, which says there's a court action coming up, wait until after the court action. And I think it's very important for us to not be disingenuous with the public. You can have a court hearing later in November. The court will not give you a decision before the beginning of next year. One or other party could then appeal. if they're not happy with the decision. That means you then have an appeal date being set. Then the appeal decision will be granted. One or other party could then take it to a higher court thereafter. Now, what that means is that we now have an extended period of uncertainty about how we're going to actually cater for 20-odd billion rands of debt and a total debt book of 30-odd billion rands for SANRAL. That uncertainty cannot be allowed. We cannot, within this fiscal framework, say we're going to provide backup for those sorts of propositions on a completely nebulous basis. And so we want to place on public record that the recent statements by the leader of AUTA are extremely irresponsible. They're extremely irresponsible. And he's not telling the public the truth. He's been consulted. He knows exactly what propositions we've offered to AUTA to find some kind of middle ground between us, and yet this process continues. And we can't hang this cloud over our heads perpetually, which means that for the next 2 years, potentially, we must start providing on the budget for the repayments that SANRAL should be making on this debt. Why can't we have a very reasonable set of proposals emerging out of very extensive consultations that the Deputy President has led, and we believe that the public should not be discouraged from doing the right thing. Statistics show that most of the people who have been using those roads for this period, and these gantries are now providing that information to SANRAL, would be paying less than 100-150 rand for a month. And so what we've been doing is getting inflated numbers being put out to the public, and there's no doubt that there are certain categories that have been disadvantaged. We've been very sensitive to that as government, and you'll find that in the new proposals, we address that, or through this consultation process over the next 30 days, we will address many of those issues as well. So I thought it's very important to underline the fact that the fiscus doesn't have the capacity for such an extended period of uncertainty to actually continue to support what we consider to be very irresponsible positions that AUTA has taken.
Are we done?
Yeah, not quite. I mean, Mr. Brown will tackle some two questions, and then the minister will and Andrew and Mr. Donaldson, and then we the minister will finish off. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The one question was, or the point that was made was by the Honourable Mr. Ross around 216. Indeed, the threat has worked. Where the Auditor General, with his latest audits on municipalities, for example, has said 40 municipalities didn't submit their financial statements on time. Immediately after that, we've reduced it to 9 municipalities already. So certainly that has worked. And also now for the audits for the next year, only 18 municipalities' financial statements are outstanding, for example. So we are now following up on that and making sure that But what is important, I suppose, is the point around how do we then build the capacity of the system to make sure proactively the system then works. What we continue to work through our provincial treasuries, and where we've seen stronger treasuries, we've seen relatively better municipal performance. If one looks at KwaZulu-Natal, for example, certainly with the over 50 municipalities there, the municipalities are relatively performing well. We look at Gauteng, we see the same kind of pattern there. So part of our support strategy is actually through the provinces, the provincial treasuries in particular. We have also deployed through the National Treasury experts in a number of those municipalities basically to support them. What we need to do as a National Treasury is to also up our monitoring of those experts to see whether we get the impact that is basically required there. But on a bigger issue is a lot of those municipalities must still appoint their municipal managers. They must still make sure that our CFO is in place, because otherwise whatever support we give to those municipalities will be futile if the key management positions are not actually filled. On the issue around maintenance, and we need to actually possibly link it also with, or rather before I get to it. Sometimes money is being put forward as the problem, and money may not necessarily be the only problem. If one looks at provinces last year, they underspend their CAPEX budget by about $2.5 billion. What stopped the provinces to redirect part of that funding to up their efforts on maintaining existing infrastructure? It's a simple issue. The other issue, if you take education, for example, we've got 26,000 schools. The machinery to maintain 26,000 schools could be complex at the end of the day. Why don't we copy countries like Uganda, for example, that has transferred certain maintenance monies directly to the schools and actually requested the school to publicize the fact that they've received the money and they will maintain it in a particular way through billboards, etc., within the school so that the communities know the money is available in the school to fix certain minor maintenance actually in the school. So our strategy around it should actually be more broader than that. In municipalities underspend their MIG allocations by about $4.4 billion last year. And certainly that's money that the municipality could have just redirected to up its maintenance there. The fact that the uptake of the EPWP is so low is certainly a concern, because that money that's available for municipalities, if municipalities were to up their game and move on the EPWP, that's one of the programs that government could, on a continuous basis, for them, and it would really deal with the issues around maintenance. But there's a broader issue around maintenance, and it has got to do with the broader life cycle of assets at the end of the day, where there's quite a weakness. In provinces, we are now implementing the infrastructure delivery management system, which takes into account the entire kind of life cycle issue there. We're rolling it out now to some of the municipalities at the end of the day. But municipalities, especially our larger ones, they don't have an excuse around capacity, if you think about it. Water losses, for example, account to over 30% of losses in some of the municipalities. Etekwini, 2-3 years ago, spent R1 billion in really refurbishing all of the bulk and reticulation water infrastructure through a loan arrangement. And the savings that they generated through that investment is now repaying for those for that specific kind of investment there. So there are these things that we will continue to work with these municipalities to just make sure that they can up their game as it relates to maintenance. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you. I was just wanted to comment on the question, specific question on the science and technology spending, and I'll say a bit about the beneficiation point that was raised also by Mr. Sigoni. Science and technology spending is projected here to grow by just 4.2%, and I think the point that looks a little low, given the importance of this in relation to broadening economic competitiveness, is quite right. We share that concern. There is a specific reason in the base on which that 4.2% is calculated, and that is that the science and technology function which we are working with here includes environmental protection, and the purchase of the Dulles research vessel is a very large capital spending item is in the base year, so it's a little artificial. The 4.2% would be considerably higher than that if it wasn't that there was that sort of lumpy capital spending item in the first year. But there's another point here that I think is worth making, which is that in our discussions with the Department of Science and Technology and the Science Council in this year's budget process, we have emphasized very strongly the point made inter alia in the ministerial review on science and technology, which has just been completed, that we need to see considerably more partnership between our science councils and the business sector. the contract work that science councils are doing is currently mainly with government departments. And so in the $14 billion or so for the science and technology function, which is in the MTF envelope, about $5 billion is the transfer spending that goes to DST and science councils, another $2 or $3 billion other votes going to science councils, $4 or $5 billion of environmental affairs spending, and then $3 billion or so of contract income that comes at present almost all from government departments. We want to see far more partnership with the private sector, but those projections are hard to make, and obviously those contracts take come into effect over time, and we're cautious in how we project them in our numbers. I expect to see the science vote spending growing quite a lot more strongly than we're showing here over time, particularly as that partnership with the private sector comes into play. And while I've got the microphone, can I make a little historical point? Somebody asked the question, has there ever been a year in which the MTBPS has lowered numbers? And the answer is yes, there was. The first MTBPS was 1997, and in the 1998 MTBPS, immediately after the East Asian financial crisis, the baseline allocations were lowered for the MTF that was announced in the 1999 budget. In relation to the point that was made on contingency reserves, it turned out they were lowered too much, and in the following budget, all those reductions were reversed and more as economic growth recovered more rapidly than was expected at that time. But remember that in the 1997 MTBPS, when the contingency was reserved was introduced, it was explained that it has three elements to it. One is provision for unforeseen and unavoidable spending in the immediate year of the budget. The other two relate to macroeconomic uncertainty and policy commitments of government and policy priorities of government that come into the spending. And so it's a wedge that rises very strongly. In 1998, it was $2 billion, $4 billion, and $8 billion. It's now $4 billion, $10 billion, or $12 billion or so, and $24 or $25 billion. And it certainly is always the intent that provides for some of the spending commitments of government that cannot be specified in the first year but come into play in the second and third years. And that, of course, is what has been done in drawing on but not fully utilizing the contingency reserve in preparing the spending plans for next year's budget.
Just in a small addition, thanks, Andrew, for that explanation. It's also the fact that it's done, by the way, this thing is done every year. Every year. And then the explanation is explicit every year. Now, the only point that I wanted to add is about this thing that why put it as if it's above the line and stuff like that. That's actually the most judicious way to do it, because in a way, if you reflect the contingency reserve as though you have already allocated it, as though you are going to spend it, therefore you reflect an overall expenditure position, an overall deficit position, as though the contingency reserve has been given out to departments to spend. That represents a real shock absorber. In other words, if there is an unforeseen event that befalls us, if there is a macroeconomic catastrophe of sorts, if there is a policy imperative that cannot wait, you can accommodate it within the same expenditure envelope without changing your overall deficit position. Now, that also does mean, by the way, that you can take roll back the contingency reserve and have a better overall expenditure and deficit position if you have got no reason to draw it down. Otherwise, if we were to say we might add $44 billion to the overall expenditure envelope should ABC happen, and then people would be asking us, are you going to add it now because it looks like you're going to have to spend this and that. I mean, it would be a bit disingenuous if we were to show it that way. I just thought I should. And as the minister was saying, there's nothing secretive about it. In every year, we explain drawdown of so much, and we set out a new call it base for the contingency.
Let me quickly round up the rest, Chairperson. Mr. Savoni asked, made some suggestions about the jobs fund. We will certainly take those up, and we're looking at them. The DORA and appropriation bill ideas around clear plans, we accept that as well. And the points made about strikes, I think the key is to get a strengthening again and an adaptation of the labor relations system so that workers feel that that system serves them, that they have lines of communication with the employer through their unions, and I think that's been given attention at the moment, and we hope that will strengthen that that area. Mr. Makubela, your point about how do we stabilize the RAND, it's a complex area, but our RAND is also tied to what the euro does. If the euro weakens, we weaken, they strengthen, we strengthen. If something happens in the country, money either leaves the country or comes into the country, and each of these factors influence. The RAND is also like sweets. It's bought, sold, handed over all over the world, not just in South Africa. So I think one day when we have more time, we can explain how the currency markets work and how different factors actually influence our environment. But like you, we would also like to see less volatility, and that gives the business community a more stable climate to work in. Chocolate. Okay. Now, the next thing you're going to tell me, which type of chocolate? You see? No, you better stick to South African chocolate. Buy local. Mr. Nene wants South African cognac as well. Mr. Habebe makes a very important point about spending in provinces. His example of Zola Hospital just captures the dilemma. 300 million becoming 880 million. Now, who was the construction company? Who's checked the costing of that hospital? How much did they walk away with, illegitimately or legitimately? I don't know. Right. And why do we allow such cost overruns? So what is the legislature in Gauteng doing about this? What's the legislatures in other provinces doing about this? We can't say we have oversight committees and then allow these sorts of things to happen. Billions of rands are going like this every week. Every week. Right. But there are beneficiaries on the other side. There's a business person or persons who benefited from this gap, legitimately or otherwise, I don't know. So I can't make accusations in this regard. But we agree with the rest of your points. I'm not sure if somebody has answers to the Gautrain ridership guarantees. I don't, so we'll try and get an answer for you. And then Mr. Donaldson will also address the EPWP question as well. Mr. Kumalo raises the question around a tightening implementation. We agree with you fully. That's a key challenge, and you can see that theme emerging constantly. And then on the question of headcount in the provinces, we'll work with the Department of Public Service and Administration, Mr. De Beer, to see how we can get that going. So from my side, thank you very much, Chair. There's one or more answers that will come from Mr. Donaldson.
Very quickly, yes, as ridership improves, the claim on the ridership guarantee should hopefully fall away. Thankfully, that's the province's responsibility, not the national government. The EPWP number for spending by municipalities, which was mentioned, I think does need a little clarification. The spending by municipalities on EPWP project is mainly through the Municipal Infrastructure Grant. What was referred to is 50% or so of drawdowns on the incentive grant. So that's a supplement to the funds that are available to municipalities. The actual spending by municipalities on EPWP project is considerably better than that, although it's not what we would like to see, certainly a full drawdown on that incentive grant, but that's not a reflection of the extent of underspending.
Around Sandrail, that we shouldn't close PPP options. So, you know, all of those options are available in the whole infrastructure process. And we'll have to look at what's the most cost-effective way of delivering a particular piece of infrastructure depending on the menu that's available to us.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, and the team for the presentation and the clarifications in terms of the questions that was asked. Honourable members, the responsibility is now with us We've now listened. We're again going to listen on the 30th of October when we go into public hearings to what stakeholders are going to tell us about the revised fiscal framework. That public hearings will run concurrent with the Select Committee for Finance, after for Appropriations, also doing the public hearings on the MTPPS. Referring to the SUP committees of Finance and Appropriation, the committee will split its members 50-50 to attend both meetings. And then on the 31st of October, the Select Committee for Finance will have a joint meeting considering the committee report. And then on Thursday, the 1st of November, the report will be considered by the National Council of Provinces and the National Assembly. That is the time frame referring to the work we have to do. We are fortunate. I think we made history today. It's the first time that we have a deputy speaker of a province in a finance appropriation meeting, deputy speaker of the provincial legislature, Northern Cape, Honorable Beekers, representing the Finance Committee in the legislature. She will be doing the briefing there. That's why provinces were present here, to go back to their provinces and do the briefings to their specific relevant finance committees, referring to the appropriations side. I must mention, Honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, in a meeting like this last year, I requested assistance for my municipality where I'm deployed, Kamisbaaf. The reality is the monument is standing in Garis called iLab that DBSA erected for us, an investment of 1 million rand, connected to your job creation skills program, giving the poor people of that area access to information worldwide. That's a message. What can be done if you take the issues to the specific committees? And I want to, in this meeting, thank you and National Treasury, a specific DBSA, Mr. Kabuka and Mr. Norman Weitz for the role they played. It was opened, it's working 110%, and even teachers are going there to be capacitated, empowered. So I want to do that formally. The other responsibility, Honourable Members, is for us to take the message we heard here today to the role players we're going to engage with when we start this weekend, the door house-to-house visits, the meetings we're going to have with stakeholders, like on Monday, Constituency Day. You have to work with your people in your constituency. Here's the message to take to them. We are having a meeting with farmers in Garis Monday afternoon, 2 o'clock, as part of the agenda. Where does the money come from to assist farmers to do fencing, etc., and buy implements? The whole question of policy, where do we come from? The fiscal policy of the governing party since 1994. There's a message in that as well. And then lastly, that we promote South Africa. Like the Honourable Member said, he met with foreigners. Go and promote your country. That's our responsibility. Be the PRO for South Africa. Thank you for the staff arranging this meeting, and thank you, Honourable, to the good lady, Mrs. Gordon, to attend as well. This meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.